You're listening to Let's Get Legal, powered by Illinois State Bar Association and hosted by John Hansen. Today's show is sponsored by attorney Anna Krolikowska, Camden Law Office, and attorney Fred Augustin. Now, here's John Hansen, and let's get legal.
All right, everyone, a happy Saturday afternoon, 3:10 on this cloudy day. Yes, this is the start of a brand new show. It's called Let's Get Legal, where we take a look at the world news, the United States news, what's happening in your everyday life through a legal lens. Hopefully answer some questions, have some fun along the way. Thank you so much for listening. We'll take you right up till 5 o'clock. Iridian's across the glass. She's producing, and we still got folks in the newsroom keeping you abreast of everything that's going on. And we are powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, so no better way to start that with the president of the State Bar Association, attorney Anna Krolikowska. Thanks for joining us today, Anna.
My pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
First guest ever. You a little nervous here?
No.
I didn't think so. You've probably faced more intense situations in a courtroom than here on the microphones.
I have.
Yeah. So tell us about the Illinois State Bar Association, because I think a lot of people think, oh, yeah, a lawyer passes the bar and then they're part of this group. But that's not the case here in Illinois.
Not quite in Illinois. So ISBA is a voluntary bar association, and that means that attorneys choose to join us, whereas in states like Wisconsin, they have mandatory bars. So in order to practice, you must belong. In Illinois, you get to make a choice.
And what does that choice bring you if you're part of the organization?
Well, you get the benefit of being a part of a great organization of 29,000 members, and we, as ISBA, work to assist attorneys in practice of law as well as promote improvements in the administration of justice. So that means we get involved with drafting and promoting legislation that impacts everyday people.
Mm-hmm.
We work on educating the public about the law, kind of like we're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
And supporting the courts and the rule of law.
That's great. You have a lot of accolades here on your list of accomplishments. Chicago Daily Law Bulletin's 40 Under 40 in 2019, and the salute of top 50 women in law in 2021. One of the first women to run the organization as president, right?
The fifth.
The fifth. That's still in the small handful, and hopefully more and more as we go on here.
Yes, let's hope so.
You have a really cool background yourself, emigrating from Poland in your teenage years, moving here to Chicago. At what point did you become interested in law?
Eighth grade constitution test, studying for that. I just got hooked.
A lot of people had a different reaction to their eighth grade constitution test.
But not the lawyers listening.
Do you think that's a similar thing? A lot of people at that moment were like, hey, this is something I want to do.
I think so. That interest in the law and how it impacts everyday matters and folks and how it can make a difference, and especially comparing it to countries where they don't have a constitution and the rule of law is not treated the same way as it is here.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, you came from an Eastern European background where different countries have gone through a lot of different things. So, I guess that you have a certain appreciation that a lot of Americans, we kind of take for granted.
Absolutely. I was actually born and lived in Poland until it stopped being communist and then moved here as a teenager. So yes, there's that appreciation.
Do you like the elements of family law for sort of the things you're talking about, the everyday laws that really impact families and doing what you can to help families navigate difficult situations?
Absolutely. Having an impact, being able to help people, and not just through the court system where the litigated cases take place, but also through mediation and collaborative process where some families choose to use those alternative dispute resolution methods to craft agreements and outcomes that are particularly suited to them.
Yeah.
So we have options.
I know a lot of people would think someone that handles a lot of divorce cases, why would you want to get into that? It seems like such a negative time for people. But of course, it can be an important and positive time for a lot of people, too. And I imagine, you know, it's not all what we see on sitcoms or we see on TV. It's a lot of important decisions that families have to make together that can end up as a net positive for people.
It can be, absolutely. And I felt like I could make a difference. In that moment, being able to say you have options, educating my clients so that they can make informed decisions, because the impact of divorce has ripples going through decades sometimes and impacting their children into adulthood.
Mm-hmm. At the ISBA, now that you're, you know, you're president, what are some of your goals here that you have during your term? How long does the term last, by the way?
So the term lasts a year.
Okay.
Initially, you run for third vice president, and then you move up into second, first, and then president.
Okay.
So I have the pleasure of serving as the 145th president of the ISBA.
Okay.
And the goals for this year are helping our attorneys practice and improve their business acumen so that they can have some help from us coming out of the COVID pandemic, which impacted all of us, but it also impacted attorneys, and majority of our members are solo and small firm practitioners. So we right. want to help them with their businesses.
Yeah.
We are also going to work on diversity, equity, and inclusion, on improving what we are doing internally at the ISBA, promoting more diverse involvement in our leadership, and also work and life and wellness balance for our practitioners and their families, because this is a very stressful and difficult profession. And if there's anything we can do to help our members and their families, we want to do that, especially now. Again, the last year has been so difficult for all of us.
For everyone. Yeah, I think people think law firms as these big, gigantic companies, and there are some, of course, but a lot of the people are just like everyone else here, trying to make it by. Anna K. Law is where you can find out more about her. Stay on board, though, because we're going to take a quick commercial break. You ain't going anywhere. We're going to talk a little bit more specifically about weddings, if you got wedding bells in the future, when to talk about that prenup conversation, and plenty more coming up here on WGN. 720 WGN. This is Let's Get Legal. I'm the host, John Hansen. This is all powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. And I got to say, we've got the wonderful president in, Anna Krolikowska. And Anna, we got a text from a 219 number saying, my father was in the first graduating class after World War II from John Marshall Law School. He always spoke very highly of the Illinois State Bar Association.
That's Thank a nice, you for that.
Yeah, there we go. 312-981-7200 if you'd like to join the conversation. Okay, so in every aspect of life, the last 15 months has been a roller coaster, not a fun one particularly, but it's, you know, it impacts all of us in our everyday lives, going to the grocery store, our plans, stuff like that. But you talk about like major institutions coming to a grinding halt and trying to navigate this world. Man, the field of law, family law, what has the last 15 months been like for you guys?
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So in Illinois, we've been very lucky in that Chief Justice Burke and the Illinois Supreme Court justices came out fairly early encouraging various districts and circuits to take a look at how we could continue to allow for access to justice, mm-hmm. because it's important and it's everyday matters that folks can't wait a year or a year and a half to address.
And when you say figure something out, like doing virtual stuff that hadn't been done in the past,
absolutely.
But instead of cameras, Zoom meetings like the rest of us?
Yes, absolutely. So in Cook County, Chief Judge Evans, and in domestic relations, Judge Dickler, really came up with an idea of how we could continue to work. And there were some emergency matters that were allowed almost from the beginning, because you can't wait on orders of protection. There's someone's life at stake at mm-hmm. that point, potentially.
Right.
But with divorce cases, for example, we started coming back virtually in June and July and having status hearings, and initially then moving on to hearings and even being able to finalize case and prove up divorces. That's that final court appearance where the judge signs a judgment
right.
and says you're divorced.
Are you saying June and July of this year?
No,
or last
year.
Okay, so a couple months of
nothing. Sorry, I should have specified.
No.
About 3 months of nothing.
Yeah, so 3 months of nothing. But you talk about 3 months of nothing, the backlog that has created. So where are we at now?
We're still dealing with that backlog. And keep in mind that divorce case filings didn't stop. Generally, financial difficulties tend to create pressure and lead to more divorces. And we were seeing signs of more divorces coming to United States and China, because they dealt with COVID prior to us, and we were seeing increased percentages of new case filings. So yes, there's still a backlog. The courts are doing a tremendous job in trying to make up the time lost. And on the other side of that, folks like me who work with collaborative process and mediation, we were able to work with our clients outside of the court system, because collaborative process and mediation, you do the work in a series of meetings, virtual in this instance, mm-hmm. and then you file a case in the court system and you almost immediately schedule that final court appearance because you have your agreement ready.
You've done the legwork already.
Exactly.
So you said that mediation, what was the other one?
Collaborative divorce.
So this is the different types of divorce. Obviously
yes.
not for everybody, but who would benefit from something like that? And what are the pros of doing it that way? And how does it work?
Well, so it is done outside of the court system, and the couple first chooses to use that process. You can't order someone to use collaborative process. With mediation, if the case is going through the court system and there are children and children's issues, yes, a judge can order mediation, but people can also choose to do it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And once they select that process, again, they would find attorneys who work in that process who help to guide them through that process and assist them in the process. And It is all done in a series of meetings, and you can bring in outside professionals. For example, in collaborative process, you can bring in mental health professionals whose job it is to act as coaches. So let's say we have a 1-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 13-year-old involved. Mm-hmm. Well, that mental health professional might be able to help the parents have a conversation in terms of how do we structure the parenting agreement and parenting time so it benefits all three children, rather than just taking a cookie cutter approach and saying you're going to do this, regardless of whether it's good for the 1-year-old or the 13-year-old.
Okay, so it comes up with a more specific plan, more tailored to the situation.
Exactly.
Who is are those situations where it's usually couples that, based on what you're the way you're detailing it to me, would seem are on a speaking manner. They have a little bit more. I don't know what the word is, but
amicable.
Yes.
Not always.
Okay.
Not always. Sometimes all it takes is that willingness to engage in that process. And at that point, we say, yes, we need those professionals. We need those mental health professionals to help us.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have to be a situation where it's a nice, easy, agreeable divorce, and that's why they're choosing collaborative. There have been some difficult cases. Folks who are dealing with mental health issues or addiction issues, to some extent, bringing in that mental health professional to help you outside of the court system might benefit the family more and might allow for, again, more tailored approach.
When is that decision on which divorce route you're going to choose done very early on?
Yes.
So they just come to you either as a couple or one individual, and they go to AnnaKLaw.com, they talk to you, and are you able to kind of navigate that world of just at least making that first initial choice?
Absolutely. That's the first thing I do in my initial consultations, explain the legal process, litigation, mediation, collaborative, and help them figure out, okay, what might work for me and my family? And then they figure out whether they want to have the conversation with their spouse, or maybe it's a situation where collaborative and mediation are absolutely not an option, and they will need to go the litigation route. But at least they have explored the possibilities, and they have the information that they need to make informed choices. That's very important to us in law, informed choices.
Mm-hmm. At least know what you're facing in either way. And then no matter what, you've even if it works out one way or the other way, at least you knew what you were getting into. So if there is someone out there that's listening, and it's been a rough past year or whatever the case may be, and they're considering getting divorced, what would you recommend for a spouse that really has that thought in their mind? Do they talk to a lawyer first? Do they talk to the spouse? How does that work?
I would talk to a lawyer first, and ideally someone like myself or myself who can speak about the three different approaches. So that way they start educating themselves before they have that conversation. It's not an easy conversation to have.
Yeah.
And it would help for them to have more of an idea, okay, what are my options? What am I willing to do? And then prepare for that conversation rather than just springing it and saying, I want a divorce, right?
Right.
And then what's going to happen.
Right, exactly. And be ready for it. An informed choice, exactly. Yeah. There. Let's talk about folks that are getting married.
Yeah.
We have so many weddings. I heard John Williams talking on Thursday on his show about people. I mean, especially if you're in that age, 25 to 35, thank goodness I just got out of that age, where you're going to like 10 in a year. Now it's even multiplied more than that because so many were in the backlog. That's still important conversation. So talking through a prenup, I know that's what a lot of people advise, getting it or not or whatever, but how do you have that conversation? Like, that's what I always want to know. My husband and I ended up not getting a prenup, probably because we didn't have the awkward conversation that people need to have through it. What's your recommendations for people?
Whether you choose to get one or not, I think there's value in having that conversation at the beginning of the process of planning your wedding, because you can talk through, are we on the same page money-wise?
Maybe not engagement night. Give it a couple days.
Yes, absolutely. Even more than that.
Okay.
But think about it. If you have the conversation early on and you start the lines of communication, are we on the same page in terms of savings? Are we on the same page in terms of when do we want to retire? Children, all of those important conversations, if you have them early on, that actually lessens the likelihood that you'll come back and see me for that divorce. So have the conversation. Here's advice from a divorce lawyer. Lines of communication. Keep them open and keep talking, because that's so critical.
If you're the spouse and your spouse approached you about it, though, is there ever that element of mistrust? Like, why is this person coming to me?
Yes, of course.
But shouldn't you as the spouse be like, oh, look, my spouse-to-be is thinking critically about what could possibly happen, right? That we should reward the spouses that come to the table with that conversation.
Well, so here are the situations where we definitely recommend having the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
There is a family or an existing business.
Mm-hmm.
there are children from a prior relationship, there are significant non-marital assets.
And you're saying that these are for sures or most likely.
Have the conversation. It's ultimately your choice whether to do it or not, but have the conversation and have it early enough, because with prenuptial agreements, they're contracts. And there are legal implications in terms of how you enter into that contract. So one, you need to give yourself enough time prior to the wedding to have the conversation.
Not you on know, a napkin at the wedding rehearsal the night before. Okay, that's not legally binding.
You know what? You don't want to take the chance of a judge 10, 15, 20 years down the road saying, no, there was no representation by counsel of each of the spouses. There was not sufficient financial disclosure, and you didn't give the other person enough time because they had just spent 6 months to a year planning this wedding. Mm-hmm. Everyone is invited, and you've spent, I don't know, $25,000, $50,000, whatever the amount is on this wedding, and there's that pressure on this person, if you don't sign, we're not getting married. So don't put yourself in that situation.
Yeah. What about for folks that have been divorced and they're kind of going through these years after divorce? Are there things that they should be aware of or think through as they go through the years after the divorce is finalized?
Are we talking in terms of possibly needing to come back to the court system or maybe to the collaborative process or mediation? Or are we talking prenuptial agreements for a future relationship?
Right. I think either one. I mean, I think that if someone's
yes
gone
to
through,
both.
Yes to both. Yeah. I guess it's a matter of like once you're done, is it you just slap the hands away? Or are there things that you need to be aware of moving forward?
Not always. So kids are going to get older, right? They're going to graduate high school. And at that point, you're looking at college expenses. And there might be financial considerations that are still, dragging on from the divorce, or sometimes maybe child support was not kept up with, or there is a change because there was a significant change in financial situation. You might need to, again, come back to the court system, or if you use collaborative process or mediation, come back to those processes. But the beauty of collaborative process is in that many instances, it improves the lines of communications so that our clients are better able to have these difficult conversations after the divorce without involving the professionals.
That makes sense.
Not a guarantee, just greater chance.
All right, we got about 30 seconds left. I want to ask, if people want to reach out to you, what are your areas of expertise? Why should people reach out to you?
So I actually can't say that I'm an expert. I can say that I focus my practice on collaborative divorce mediation and family law, and they can either go to annaklaw.com or reach me at 847-715-9328.
I learned a lot there in that conversation. It's important things to have. Look, difficult conversations are what they say. They're difficult, but they're important. They can save you a lot of headache in the long run if it's up to you. Come back again. I hope we'll chat more because I
would love to.
Yeah. And we can, during the commercial break, we were talking about a Middle Eastern relation. We'll have a whole other show on that. Or Eastern European.
Different show.
Different show. Yeah, okay. Anna K. Law, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. All right. Nothing's been hotter over the last couple months in the real estate market. Real estate attorney Kevin Camden, Camden Law Office, joining me. Kevin, how you doing, my friend?
Doing very well, John. Good to see you today.
I wanted to start there because I was listening to Hochberg earlier, and Amy Kite was saying that the market slowed down a little bit here or there. You're starting to see a little equilibrium, right?
We are. I think there's a seasonal slowdown. People are tired as it comes into the 4th of July holiday. We've got buyers that have put 3, 4, or 5 offers in some circumstances, and we're starting to see it swing back to 1, 2 offers, maybe. And it's starting to pick up again. We also see more new construction, which we haven't seen in the last several months.
Yeah, well, because lumber finally coming down in cost, accessibility, new construction. I know a lot of people are going that route because there wasn't the inventory.
There were a lot of people that were starting to go that way and then pulled back because of commodity prices. And now we see builders with multiple developments as well as tract housing, which we haven't seen in quite a while, starting to come out of the ground, which is good.
Yeah. All right. So as a real estate attorney, so I just went through my first sale of a condo ever, which is, as always, was an eye-opening experience, just like buying for the first time was. And I just appreciate having a real estate attorney who knows what they're doing. What is it like for you when the market is this hot? Like, what are the red flags you're looking for at any time when you're dealing, whether it's buyer or seller?
So we've seen a number of red flags over the past month, month and a half. Sellers jumping, just deciding to put their house on the market with no place to go. which is dodgy, as you might understand. We've seen folks who were thinking about retiring, moving out of state, upsizing, downsizing, whatever the case may be, just rolling the dice to see where they can go. And unfortunately, on the buy side, we've seen folks kind of get shut out because we see a number of contracts that are coming in over list, which raise a number of potential issues that we have to deal with. It's interesting, and when lawyers say interesting, you know, sometimes that translates to more expensive, but the reality is it's fun. I mean, for the folks that are in it on a routine basis, and I know Amy and David have been in it for a long time, it's a great market to be in.
Yeah, for sure. I was just kind of curious, for, let's say someone is looking to enter the market as a buyer right now, what are some things that you recommend even before they get to that point where they start looking, things that they need to think about what the process is going to be like when they deal with you?
Have your folks lined up. Often lawyers are the last people brought in as part of the team, and not surprisingly, from a professional perspective, we'd like to see the lawyers be number one. Have your financing teed up and ready to go. This is not the market to be rolling the dice, whether or not you're prepared to purchase or not. And then partner with a good realtor that knows the area and is prepared to show you a number of homes and give you the benefit of their experience.
All right. What do you recommend for someone that really is looking for that house of their dreams? What do they need to be ready to do? So how do they make that more enticing offer? Like, I mean, how do they
come in cash heavy? Yeah. Consider coming in with as low of a loan as you can possibly get away with. Don't make any repair requests. Consider waiving inspections and really go for it. The mm-hmm. key is, if you know, cash is king, right? As the saying goes, if you can come in as a cash buyer, you're always going to be the preferred. But if you can come in with a lower than 20% down, 30-40% down, you're much more attractive to sellers because your financing is going to be solid irrespective of where appraisals may come in.
What about, and well, let's pause there for a second, because this is a situation that I went through. Not to get too personal, but we sold our house for list price. Great, that's awesome. Appraisal comes in and it has not caught up yet to what this market is. Way lower. Are you seeing that a lot for people that are thinking, oh man, I'm going to walk away with a chunk of change, and it turns out their house is in value for what they think it is?
We are. So coming out of COVID, we had a lot of appraisers that weren't doing on-site or field appraisals. They were doing desktop, which isn't good or bad, which we understand because of COVID. We're seeing the market catch up a little bit with what comparables are, and we're seeing buyers come in waiving appraisals, which is interesting because, as we just talked about, you can waive an appraisal, but unless you've got a big stockpile of cash, you can't really do it with a loan. So there's some intricacies you want to work through with your attorney and certainly your lender to make sure that you're in a position to do that.
Is there anything that you can really do if that appraisal comes in way lower? I mean, are there appeals processes? If it was a desktop one, can you request an in-person one?
You can request that it be challenged, but the reality is, in my experience, you can bridge a gap. Hypothetically, if an appraisal comes in, and this happened to one of my clients recently, $30,000, $40,000 under.
Yeah.
We might be able to get you to $20,000 more than what the appraiser came in at, but there's still going to be a difference that we're going to have to work out. We're not going to have somebody look at it and say, oh, we wildly missed it, so you're right. It should be list price.
Right.
It has to be a working relationship between the parties.
When should someone, I know you mentioned when you assemble the team, it's sort of the last piece of the puzzle. I mean, are there advantages to bringing an attorney in right from the get-go?
I believe there are, of course, from a professional perspective. You want us to be aware of what you may be able to do, and you want some advising. If you're going to be an FHA buyer, for example, you've got some limitations and some hurdles that we'll have to work with you with. If you're a cash buyer, of course, we've got very few things that we have to worry about. In other circumstances, you'll want guidance with respect to what inspection issues you may raise. In this market, and we've seen it pull back a little in the past couple of weeks, sellers have been very hesitant to accommodate inspection requests because the market was heavily in their favor. Pendulum starting to swing back towards the middle, and I'm seeing more sellers say, okay, we'll make the accommodation and do these sorts of things. You want to know going in, what is it that we should be asking for by way of repairs? What are things that we're looking for? A client this week, for example, talking about a multi-unit, so a condominium, concerned about a dog. And you think, well, that's not really a big deal. Well, it can be a big deal.
Yeah. I couldn't even believe what happened when we started listing our place, and it was obviously that we were moving. The number of things I got in the mail from people, from attorneys trying to sell me their business, and they came in with some like this lowest price. Like, I couldn't even imagine, you know, buying, retaining an attorney for some rate that they that seem to be pittance, but like that's why you, I mean, you really need someone that is going to tackle, someone like the, you and the folks from Camden Law Office that know the ins and outs of this stuff, know how to work it, because there are some real pitfalls if you end up with an attorney that doesn't know what they're doing or doesn't have a lot of focus on what your specific case is.
Absolutely. In a hot market, we see attorneys that don't necessarily practice in the real estate arena jump in because it seems like easy pickings. I like to work with a team. I like to work with my referral sources, both lenders and realtors, on a regular basis. We know what to expect of each other. We know who's going to do what and why. But the reality is it's an open market, and I understand that and I appreciate it. You just want to make sure that somebody that you're working with, this isn't, you know, your cousin who hasn't done a deal in 10 or 15 years. And
well, you don't know my cousins, because, yeah, I don't want to hire any of my cousins, trust me, not for this. But no, you want someone with the trusted name. I mean, really, because there are so many things as someone who just sold for the first time that, like, you would just have no idea on it. It just felt so good having someone that knows the whole process. And I imagine that that's what that trust, like, that just helps you sleep at night.
I think it's important for clients that they know the folks they're working with have that experience. And the reality is we need to be available. I've handled several phone calls and emails today regarding purchases and sales. And the folks that are in it day to day, we get it. Realtors work on the weekends pretty routinely. So I think right. It's important that I'm available to answer their questions.
Right. Kevin Camden, Camden Law Office, stay right there. I want to talk about commercial real estate. I also want to talk a little bit more about that closing day, things that can happen on that as well. After this, here on Let's Get Legal on WGN. Here with Kevin Camden of Camden Law, we're talking about all things real estate, the hot market, the equilibrium we might be getting in. But, you know, that closing day, Kevin, is very stressful for buyers, for sellers, and for attorneys, I imagine, because there's things that can happen on that day that you don't expect, and maybe people should just think through everything before it comes.
We strive to make sure they're as calm as can be, but the reality is there's hiccups all the time. Movers are late. Funding documents don't come through. I've had situations where during the walkthrough before closing, sellers are still asleep haven't started packing anything.
Oh my gosh.
And we get into a whole host of issues.
Closing day starts at the start of the day. Yes, it's not.
Well, I think sellers need to anticipate closing. The date on the contract should be the day you're striving toward. It's not kind of a guideline. It's pretty much the day that we expect you to be out of the house.
Right.
And when you're not, that creates issues.
Yeah, it creates issues. I imagine that those are conversations, at least, again, having someone like you at the helm can help navigate those waters. Because if you have someone else, it can be a difficult situation. Are there any other things for sellers? Because we talked a little bit about what buyers should know or think about. From a selling standpoint, What are some must-knows for a seller as they talk to attorneys about what's coming up for them?
Have an idea of where you're moving to. You don't necessarily have to have a purchase contract, but at least have an idea, particularly if you're moving out of state, know the community you want to move to. Consider renting. I suggest this very routinely. Sell your place, and then you might want to rent for 2 or 3 months if you're moving out of state. Have your stuff ready to go. Start talking to movers sooner rather than later, right? If your closing is going to be August 15th, I recommend you do not try and hire movers on August 10th. It doesn't work well, right?
No. Then you get your cousins who bring over the van.
Exactly.
And the pickup truck. Yeah, my brother has a pickup truck. He was very excited when I finally hired movers this time that he didn't have to be the one lugging my stuff around on the back of his truck.
Well, we all pay college friends back once, right, for pizza and beer on that first move. Some of my college friends are still extending those opportunities, but I don't think that's going to happen anymore.
Yeah, have that all lined up. You know, you mentioned like that selling process and where people are buying and sell all that at the same time, all the dominoes that have to kind of be lined up, that can be really intimidating for people, and rightfully so, right? There's a lot of common pitfalls, but I guess I take solace in knowing that a lot of people have done it before. A lot of people will keep on doing it. Do you meet with a lot of people that are nervous about certain things, and at least you can walk them through, you know, here's a potential problem for this domino. Here's where I'm lining up and seeing this may not work out as well as you think. That's why someone like you is helpful to identify where there might be problems in the hiccups.
We want to provide security so that our clients understand exactly what's going to happen. The reality is, if you're selling and trying to buy on the same day, your buyer is probably trying to buy and sell on the same day, and their buyer is trying to buy or sell. So as we paint the picture, which is difficult on radio, a number of things have to line up. So we try and set expectations early on. If we want to do a simultaneous purchase where we're going to sell in the morning and buy in the afternoon, sometimes, and it takes a collaborative effort among among a number of attorneys, realtors, and lenders to make sure everything comes together. The problem becomes everybody wants to move on June 30th before the July 4th holiday.
Right.
Well, if one of those dominoes doesn't fall the right way, everybody has to rejigger to make sure that we can make it occur.
If someone's on the fence about whether to list their home or not, do you have any advice for them at this point?
List it. In this market, list it. We don't have enough home stock in Illinois right now. Take the opportunity, list it, start looking quickly where you might want to move to. Start thinking about a long closing date. Many of the contracts I'm seeing, which is unusual, have 60. I've had more than a couple with 90-day closing dates to give the sellers the opportunity and to find what it is that they're looking for. So don't wait, particularly as we have folks coming in. It's mid-July, right? July 10. If you're looking at a 30 to 45 close, folks want to move for school districts. That we're butting right up against that August 30, September 1 date. List it.
Yeah. I know a lot of people say, oh, I can handle this myself and I can be my own advocate. First of all, are they legally, I mean, do you have to have a real estate attorney legally? And even if you don't, what would you say to someone that thinks they're going to navigate it on their own?
I encourage my for sale by owners to think long and hard about not using a realtor. There's a reason why those professionals make the commissions that they do, from things as simply as staging and making the home look good, which may not be important in a hot market, but for sale by owner, are you prepared to be available for inspections? Are you prepared to be around for appraisals? And a lot of folks are not, and they don't understand the things that are involved. It's more than just saving a few bucks with respect to a commission.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about commercial real estate. Obviously, things have been turned upside down in the world of commercial real estate with COVID-19 and, you know, the move to so many companies going all digital, whatever the case may be. How's that market looking now?
Depends where you're at. Much like real estate is local, 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 right? We hear that all the time. Depending upon what industry you're in, finance, for example, is making a big push. Goldman, JP Morgan, they want their folks back after Labor Day in offices. Other employers are taking advantage of remote work or smaller office space out in the suburbs. So it really depends on what it is that your employer's preference may be. I can tell you, having been in the market last fall and early spring for my own office, smaller office space, we're not seeing any reduction in price. And to a degree, I think we're seeing a premium, because the reality is if you've got 50 or 100,000 square feet, there aren't a lot of competitors in that regard. Universally.
Right.
If you've got 1,500 to 3,000 square feet, there are a lot of guys like John and Kevin that may be working from a smaller office. There's no reduction in demand in those sorts of areas. So it depends on where you're at, and really it depends on where your company's at. I have clients on a routine basis that tell me out in the western burbs they're going to be remote for the foreseeable future, so they're taking opportunities to move, expand, you know, do those sorts of things.
Yeah. When I think about, I decided to rent for just a little bit of time and just to figure out what's next. And, you know, it's working out well for us. It's fine because we were able to move in before the move out date. That made things a little bit smoother. There was a point where I considered actually renting my own place and trying to navigate those waters. We didn't eventually do that. I know a lot of people want to maybe rent their place to keep it as a property. Any advice for someone going along those ways? I mean, I imagine that having a legal mind look over leasing documents, that sort of thing, is important too.
I think that's significant. I think you need folks that are well aware of what the Chicago Landlord Tenants Ordinance requires. Cook County has added a layer onto that. And for my investor clients, I tell them all the time, be it your first or your 10th or whatever the number is, you're going to have to deal with an eviction process eventually. It's not a question of if, but when. Many landlords can dodge it for a long time, but it ultimately comes up and you need to be prepared to deal with that. COVID is sort of created a tremendous amount of turbulence with respect to state and local, but I think it's a great opportunity. Real estate is one of the few things that over time, irrespective of downturns like 08 or 09, you still get a significant return on your investment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. All right, Kevin, what sorts of people are you looking for to reach out for you guys? It's buyers, sellers, anyone in between, commercial. Who should be calling you?
Anybody that's looking to buy or sell in this market who is looking for folks that are seasoned and prepared to represent them. We do work in the city on a routine basis. We're out in the western suburbs where my office is at in Downers Grove on a regular basis. We're looking to work with folks who want to deal with seasoned professionals.
Well, and, you know, really to that point, I just like knowing that my lawyer has seen it all. I don't know. There's like a comfort in that, that you guys, you know, you've been through different circumstances, and having a team like yours is helpful.
Many deals will close regardless of how good or bad the attorney is. The difference between the folks that have seen it all, as you talk about, John, and the folks that may be newer, for those 4, 5, 6 deals out of 100, we can close them. We're prepared to deal with what those surprises. Nobody likes surprises on closing day.
No, not at all. No one wants to see the previous people still sleeping there. So, Kevin, I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Camden Law Office. You can go to CamdenLawOffice.com. This is Let's Get Legal, and you just heard his name there, Fred Augustin, joining us now, talking about all things property taxes. Fred, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
I think that our property tax world, a lot of people, all it is to them is they see what the bill is, they shake their head, they say a curse word I'm not going to say on the air, and then they pay their bill, not even realizing that there's a whole process. There's people like you that can help them out, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and I think that people just, they just assume that that's what it is, and that's the way it will always be. So backing up a little bit, your background is really interesting. You were on the Cook County Board of Review for a while, where you kind of heard a lot of these appeals and stuff like that. And I that imagine that has prepared you to help represent people as best as possible.
That is correct. You know, sitting on the Cook County Board of Review, if people don't know what the Cook County Board of Review is, it's one of the entities in Cook County where you could appeal your taxes. So there are two places. It's really the Cook County Assessor's Office and the Cook County Board of Review. And I sat on the Cook County Board of Review. I was an analyst and hearing officer. So yeah, I mean, I've heard, reviewed all the appeals in Cook County. So
yeah, you know what potentially to look for and help people out. Before we get a little bit deeper into it, I do want to bring up, because we've been talking about this story through the news all day, that this senior freeze tax error that the Sun-Times had exposed could potentially delay property tax bills from coming out. They were scheduled to be delivered August 1st, but because of what they consider major errors in this $250 million a year program, could end up having these bills come out. I know this is brand new news and you're looking through it too. You read the story. Any thoughts on this news for what it could mean potentially for Cook County residents?
You know, my view is it's not so much the residents. It's the taxing bodies that benefit from these tax dollars. Because normally in a normal year, your second installment bill comes out July 1st.
Mm-hmm.
This year, obviously with COVID, it was delayed and they're set to do August 1st. Now, with the further delay, who knows when those second installment tax bills, and really, it's the taxing bodies, the governments that rely on the funding. Those are the ones who are going to be affected from this.
Right, because I'm going to pay no matter what. Whether it's a couple weeks later or not is less important to me. I mean, either way, it's not like we're getting a break from it because it's later. It's not going to change much. But the actual dollars coming in, the revenue in which these cities or municipalities need to use, that is going to be the affecting thing. So for the average person, you say not too much to worry about here.
That's correct. Not too much.
All right.
Not too much to worry about.
The other big story was out of the Rogers Park neighborhood. There's this, they were doing the 3-year assessment. Cranes did some reporting on this, and there was residential buildings or apartments that were seeing like a 290% tax increase. All part of the plan and the idea is that they're taxed differently because they're a business, right? Or because it's landlords in theory. But that's going to really, could really trickle down. What are you anticipating here? Because Rogers Park was first because they were one of the first ones reassessed this year. Is this what we're expecting across all of Chicago?
I would say yes. So, you know, the way it kind of works in Cook County, so Cook County, it's divided into three groups in terms of its reassessment. So mm-hmm. one group, it's the northern part of Cook County, so like cities like Wilmette, Glenview. Another group is southern Cook County, which is like Matteson, Homewood, and then Chicago. It's its own group. And so, you know, last year it was the southern Cook County that got reassessed, and you saw the same percentages increase in terms of the reassessment values. Commercial properties, I had one that went up 80% from the previous triennial period. So, I mean, you're starting to see a pattern that, Rogers Park, you're seeing it again. So as these city townships open, do not be surprised for the increases.
Can commercial buildings and can they appeal just like normal residents can, or is that a different process?
No. Same process. Obviously, the basis of the appeal would be different.
Right.
But no, it's, you could appeal either if you're a commercial owner or if you're a homeowner.
Yeah, I imagine that, you know, someone says, well, I live in a home, my taxes will go up, it's not a commercial building. But if you're a renter in one of these buildings, you can bet your butt that they're going to be passing that cost onto the renters, I would imagine.
Yes, and I mean, remember, you know, affordable housing is a big item here in the city of Chicago. And, you know, affordable housing, a lot of people are renting. And so with these increases, especially with multifamily buildings that are 6 units or more, if you're seeing a 200 increase in an assessment or an 80% increase, of course, that will equate to higher taxes. So what is the landlord going to do? Mm-hmm. They're going to pass it along to the tenant. So then the tenants have to bear the burden. So how affordable are these units going to be? And right, that's going to be an issue.
Yeah, for sure. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We're going to have more with Fred Augustin from Meritus Law. By the way, I just want to list this because this is one of the best websites I've ever had to read. FightYourPropertyTaxes.com is where they can reach you. We're going to get into that after the commercial break about how, when, why you should fight your property taxes and the best ways to do that here on Let's Get Legal on WGN. We're talking about real estate taxes and navigating that difficult world. We got Fred Augustin in. He's joining us from Meritus Law. Fred, we talked about earlier the idea that I think a lot of people love to complain about taxes, and why not? It's fun. But then you pay it and you don't think about it. I think that there's a lot of people out there that don't realize that you can appeal the assessment, the assessed value of your home. So I got to ask you just off the bat, do you love your job? Because when you do what you do, you are saving people a lot of money.
I do love it because you are literally, the way I view it is you're helping people,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah. So how does someone get started? Like, I mean, when in the process, at what point can you say, this is too much, I want to appeal this? How does that work? Explain this, how taxes get assigned through the assessment process and when that window of opportunity is.
Yeah, and that's a good question because I think a lot of people get confused in terms of what you're actually appealing.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, when I get calls complaining about their actual tax bill, I always tell them, well, we can't appeal that amount.
Right. You're paying that.
Yeah, you're paying that. That's done and over with. If you wanted to appeal that, you should have done it a year before.
Okay.
So what are you appealing? You're actually appealing the property's assessment. And the property's assessment is included in the formula in terms of how they calculate taxes.
Okay.
Which is a property's assessment times the state equalizer times a local tax rate equals your tax amount.
Okay.
So you're appealing your property's assessment, not the tax amount.
I'm glad you know that formula because I'm not writing that one down. But yeah, exactly. So in Cook County, it's every 3 years. Different counties, some go every 4 years. So when they reassess, they let you know how much the property was valued at. Is that your only window to file? Like if you then start getting your new tax bill, do you have to wait another 3 or 4 years or can they reach out to you to challenge it even years later?
So yes. So in terms of, let's just say you brought up a good example. Let's just say Rogers Park, they got their, you know, owners got their assessment,
mm-hmm.
reassessment notice. That begins the window for filing an appeal with the Cook County Assessor's Office.
Okay.
And you have 30 days to file that appeal.
So you got to get on that.
You have to get on that. However, in Cook County, remember, as I alluded to earlier, you still have a second chance to appeal later in the year with the Board of Review, where I used to sit on.
Okay.
So you have two bites at the apple, so to speak, every year. A lot of people get confused in terms of a reassessment versus a tax appeal.
Okay.
For reassessment, it's every 3 years in Cook County. However, when you're filing your property tax appeal, you could appeal every year.
Okay.
So you don't have to do it every third year. You could actually do it every year.
Is there like a letter you have to wait for to see that amount and that's when you do it? Or can they reach out to you at fightyourpropertytaxes.com at any time?
Well, the best way to possibly is to reach out to me,
yeah.
because normally you get the notice in Cook County during your reassessment year.
Okay.
So the subsequent years in the triennial period, if it's your second or third year in the triennial, you don't get a notice.
Okay.
So really, you know, all the townships are published on the assessor's office and, you know, I monitor that every day.
Right.
So I know when it's up, when it's not up, you know, and so forth.
You'll navigate that water for them. What are they looking for? How do they assess these properties? Because I lived in a multi-unit property. We ended up doing an appeal where we all kind of teamed up together. I imagine that's a recommended practice for people. But like, what goes into it? I mean, are they taking a look at market trends, size of the home? Like, walk us through what happens through that.
So, you know, the way to really think about it is there's two groups of properties. There's the commercial industrial type and there's the residential type. Residential, let's just take, for example, single-family homes. You could appeal it based on what they call uniformity, and that's just the process of finding homes essentially that are very similar to your home that have a lower assessment per square foot. Mm-hmm. We don't have to get into that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's my job to get into that. So that's one option. Or as a single family homeowner or owner of a three flat, you could also appeal it based on your recent sale. Recent sale meaning the last 3 years. And you should only use your recent sale if that recent sale is lower than what you got reassessed at.
Right. Yes. Yes, for sure. How, I mean, I know it's a difficult number, but until you reach out to someone like you, you have no idea what you could potentially get. I mean, I'm sure there's some cases where you aren't able to drop it all that much, but some by a lot. I guess it just varies on the many different variables in the situation.
Yes, it does. And it varies with the data. You know, not every home or every commercial building is the same. So mm-hmm. there's a lot that goes into it. And, you know, one home on the same block may be paying X. Another home, because it's different, may be paying Y. So it's different. I mean, it's different for each home. Each property is unique.
Right, exactly. What about people that have made a lot of changes to their homes over the past years? And they renovated their kitchens, they redid that. Is that going to show up on assessments, or is that not something that gets that detailed into what they are doing every couple of years?
You know, in Cook County, it's very difficult to get into that detail because mm-hmm. when they do their reassessment, it's what they apply is a mass appraisal system. A mass appraisal system is really just, it's an analysis of the data.
Mm-hmm.
And really what they look at are similar single family homes or similar commercial buildings that sold in the last 3 years. So based on that data, they try to assess you based on that.
Right.
Which is why I think people need to appeal, because they're not going to always get it right.
Right.
So that's why it's important to appeal.
Talk about vacancy and uninhabitable relief. What is that, and who does that apply to?
So that applies to any property owner. For residential properties, let's just say if you're a single-family home, if you're rehabbing it, mm-hmm. And you can't live there, meaning it's uninhabitable, you could get additional tax relief for that. So
okay.
what they call it, it's a partial assessment. And that's only for 1 year only, and then what happens at the end of the year for the next year, it reverts back to a full assessment. So it's a nice benefit to have, especially if you're not living in the property. Same thing with commercial buildings. If it's rendered uninhabitable, if there's damages, or if you're doing rehab to it, you could get a partial assessment for that.
So that's fire and water damage. You're not living there. And I think that you just brought up a great point about, especially about this. There are so many programs out there that people could take the benefit of that maybe don't know it or don't apply for it. I remember there was an assessment. I don't know exactly what it was, but I went to the assessor's office. I went to the website, realized that I hadn't applied for it. Maybe it was a new homeowner's exemption. I don't remember what it was. Ended up with saving $500, getting a check in the mail. I think there's a lot of things for people out there that they don't realize. Are you able to help people navigate those waters too, to at least let them know, hey, here's what you might be eligible for?
Yes, you know, I could guide them. I really don't get into the exemptions part because
okay.
that's kind of an after-tax benefit.
Uh-huh.
You know, it has nothing to do with the property tax appeal realm. But for residential properties, if you've lived there as of January 1st of any given year, yes, you should get a homeowner's exemption. If you're 65 years or older, you should get a senior exemption.
Mm-hmm.
If you qualify for a senior freeze, as, you know, there's that article that came out earlier
right.
today. I mean, that's another benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So, the Cook County Assessor's website really lays it out pretty well in terms of, you know, exemptions that are out there for commercial properties. There are incentives that they could apply for. I could help out with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there's a lot of resources there that people should really look into.
Do you feel like this is how I felt as a homeowner, was I just – once you start trying to get into the weeds of how it is done, how things are assessed, what your taxable rate, all that sort of stuff, I feel like – is it designed to be confusing so that I don't say anything about it? I mean, I know it's more complicated than that, but I feel that that's intimidating for a lot of people.
Yes. I mean, as an average homeowner, yes, it could be very intimidating. And that's why there are, you know, someone like me who could assist with that process. And, you know, that's why you hire a lawyer.
Yes. How are you always cracking new law books? Like, anytime there's a new tax rule? I mean, I always wonder, like, how you keep up, how a lawyer like you keeps up with all the changes that happen. Because law changes all the time. I imagine that obviously it's your job to, but it must be difficult to always keep up with that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and funny you mentioned that, you know. I am a member of the ISBA, and, you know, I'm a member of their, I get the state and local tax committee information, and that provides good update information monthly or sometimes even weekly information, and that's how you keep up with it.
Yeah. What about, I know a lot of people, obviously, we were just talking about this hot real estate market. A lot of people have bought, they're going to a place. They may not realize that they're about to be reassessed and what that could be. I mentioned you hear from a lot of people who bought the house at a certain price and a certain tax bracket without realizing that next year is going to be the reassessment. I mean, that's something that people should keep in mind when they're looking through that sort of stuff. Or, and if they end up getting a huge bill, come to you.
Yes. Especially if you're, let's just say, for instance, you bought this year and you're getting reassessed next year. You know, when the Cook County assessor starts looking and reviewing the assessments for that given property, I mean, they're going to look at that, how much you purchased it for. I mean, so it's on the record. They'll also look at other similar types of homes that sold there. So yes, it's something to think about, really.
What evidence do you bring about a property's value? What are you looking at? You're looking for like specific mistakes, or is it like, hey, you didn't take this into consideration? I mean, how specific to the home do you get when you are arguing that that person should be paying a lower tax than they are?
Well, for residential properties, single family homes to four units, you get pretty specific. You know, you really want to be similar where, you know, you have to find similar comps that are similar in size, similar age, and similar in location. So really, you do get in the weeds with that.
Right.
Commercial property is a little different. If it's a leased property, you know, they're going to want to look at the lease agreement. So I need to review the lease agreement. I need to review the historical income and expenses for the property, because in Illinois and in Cook County, income-producing properties should be assessed based on the income flow. So, you know, it's a different analysis.
Right, because what you're suggesting is obviously that the county, they may not have the resources to go home by home, room by room. They just apply this one-size-fits-all approach, not quite that broad, but specific to a couple of things, whereas you can then say, well, look, I understand that that's your process, but here's the specifics on what is different about this particular property compared to some of the others, or look at these other ones and notice this trend or this, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
Do you get a lot of pushback? Like, what is that process like that you go through? Is it, you know, you file and you immediately hear back? Is there a lot of back and forth sometimes between you and the county fighting for someone's property tax? Walk us through a little of that.
It depends. With the Cook County Assessor's Office, you really don't get any feedback. It's you file your appeal, and then you get your decision, you know, within 30 or 60 days, and that's it. Cook County Board of Review is a little different. You could always ask for a hearing, meaning you can meet with an analyst about it. So, you know, more times than not, especially for commercial properties, that's what I do. Or if the commercial property is very unique and complicated, where you literally have to walk step by step with the hearing officer in terms of what's going on and so forth. So that's what you need to do. And that's what I do a lot for a lot of these, you know, commercial properties, condominium buildings. I represent a lot of condominium buildings. I usually try to talk to someone at the board of review about it, because you're really analyzing the sales within the condominium.
Right. All right. Someone's listening right now. They're upset about their taxes. So every single listener right now, essentially, how can they reach out to you? What's the best way to find out about you and everything that you do?
Best way to reach me out, I mean, you alluded to, is our website, fightyourpropertytaxes.com. That'll get to the firm's website. You'll have my contact information. You know, once you get to the website, make sure to click on the firm title. And then you'll find my contact information. You could email me. Our phone number is listed. Contact me anytime.
Fred, thank you so much. And for saving everyone money. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Our next guest is the Director of Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Professor Robin Wilson has written 13 books, is incredibly accomplished. So, Professor, I thought I'd bring you on to talk about Britney Spears.
Hey, thanks, John. I appreciate it. I love Britney.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting how, well, first of all, I was a big fan of her music. That was right when I was in high school. So, of course, everyone knew Britney Spears then. And, you know, there was some rough years where she was in the tabloids and she sort of made a comeback. But, you know, she's in the spotlight now because of this conservatorship, which I don't even know if I'm saying that correctly. But Professor Wilson, her case is really interesting. And I imagine, and because I think you even talk about it in your law classes, I mean, it's a real interesting case to learn from and to get, you know, learn a little bit more about this process.
Yeah, you know, John, it's really interesting. I mean, this is an accomplished woman. I mean, she's running Vegas shows and got, you know, doing the choreography with dancers. And, I mean, can anybody say she's hasn't really succeeded in life? And yet she's stripped of almost every right that an adult would have. You know, I was sort of like running down the constitutional rights that we talk about in law school, you know, the right to control your reproduction. Brittany mm-hmm. doesn't have that, you know, right to decide what medicines you're going to take or not take, or autonomy over your body. Not for Brittany, you know, no control over her money. And, you know, conservatorships were devices to try to help somebody who would be subject to fraud or undue influence, or where they had a demonstrated inability to take care of their own money, to basically have someone do that for them. But the effect here is that it stripped her of almost everything. She can't even ride in a car with her own boyfriend without permission.
Wait, how does that happen, though? Like, I mean, there obviously had to be some hearing at the beginning of all this to set it up, and maybe there were circumstances that made sense then, but isn't it written in that at a certain point this stuff goes away? Like, how does that happen in the United States of America to a successful woman?
It seems stunning, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, this isn't like, you know, bread on the shelf that just expires. You have to go through actually a really hard process. And if you listen to her, everybody should listen to her 24-minute statement, because it's just really powerful, because she's stripped of all these rights and she keeps saying, don't evaluate me. You know, I don't want to be evaluated anymore. I just want to decide to see my own therapist. I want to see my therapist in my home where there isn't paparazzi. And meanwhile, all the people around her, John, who've been making hundreds of thousands of dollars for, quote, managing her life, you know, they're making gobs of money. And if you listen to her allegations in the statement, there's a real question about whether the court ought to be investigating what they've been doing. And there's actually a process for that. So there is a process for getting out of a conservatorship. She took the first step, which was speaking to the judge the other day. But the judge has a lot of tools in their arsenal and you know, to be evaluating whether this has really served this woman well. And well, I guess we'll see whether the judge does that.
Yeah, what is next in this process? Is it just a one ruling? Are there going to be more hearings? I know that there was some, you know, back and forth on what would be made public, and Brittany wanted certain things out, and her speech was really compelling and what you heard about her testimony. But what happens next now? I mean, is the judge just sitting there trying to consider it, or are there going to be more interviews with other folks? Do you know what happens next in this process?
Well, to get the conservatorship in place, they often take testimony from witnesses. I can't tell you for sure what I think the judge is going to do,
right.
But I think having heard Brittany, I think there'll be a lot of investigation into what have the people who are supposed to have her best interest at heart. That's what the conservatorship is supposed to be about, protecting Brittany's interests. She's sort of given the judge a lot of fodder for thinking that perhaps maybe these folks have overreached and, you know, are not always guided by her best interests. And even if they are, they just went too far. You know, like, you know, she says there are six nurses there all day and they even watch her undress and dress. Like, what's that about?
How?
Oh, yeah. It was in her allegations. Yeah, she said that. And imagine, you know, just think about if you were subjected to that all day long. You're like a bug under a microscope or something. And then you are, ironically, the person who's making all the money that keeps all of these people going, right? I mean, she's sitting on, you know, a huge empire in some sense, and she's the person with the least amount of power, at least if you believe her statement.
Part of it was just so shocked that this has been going on for so long, and it didn't become until this Free Britney movement really became a thing this year. Not a lot of people knew about it. I can't believe she wasn't screaming from the high heavens every single day for the last 15 years or whatever.
Yeah, it's been since 2009. And, you know, you started off your, you know, the beginning of the show saying, you know, she had some tough years. She did. That's the part that I actually teach in my family law class. We sort of, like, survey all of divorce and marriage law by using Britney Spears. But you'll remember that she married her high school sweetheart Jason Alexander on like the January 2nd, you know, in Vegas, right? So she marries him in Vegas. She annuls that 2 days later. And the same year, she marries K-Fed in a, quote, faux wedding, which wasn't the actual wedding. And both, here's a woman at the time at $26 million. And she marries two different people in the same year without a prenup, right? Like, you don't see Oprah doing this kind of stuff, right? And to get in a conservatorship, you have to have, like, massive meltdown. It can't just be a single event. That's the test. It can't be a single event. It has to be a pattern that shows that you're incapable of running your own life, okay? Well, maybe back in that time frame and right after that, when she had the little kids and then she got divorced, like, boom, 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 you might have said, okay, yeah, that's, you know, she maybe isn't able to do that. But we're really far past that.
Yeah.
You know, your heart comes out to her when you listen to this 24-minute statement because you feel like she'll never get out from underneath it.
Yeah.
I'm sure she feels that way.
So how can someone just bring that? Like, where does someone even start? Obviously, it was her dad that initiated this, correct?
It was. You know, and it sounds like kooky stuff, John, in America. But the truth is we use these devices for lots of people who are disabled. So
Right. Imagine...
I write about a case in my treatise about a Down syndrome woman, so a grown Down syndrome child. They're not children anymore, but a grown woman. And her parents were raising her. And the case was about her, at that time, guardianship. So we use the same word for children, guardianship, and when they age out of being a child, we'll still consider somebody their guardian. If it doesn't happen until you're an adult, we call that a conservatorship, but it's the same sort of device. And in those cases with, like, disabled folks, a lot of these folks are never going to have the capacity to run their own life, like the Down syndrome woman that I'm talking about. So her parents had to go through a structure to make sure that they could continue to make decisions for her like she was a legal child, right? That's what's happened to Brittany. Here's this amazing woman, 39 years old, and she's a legal child in terms of the law. That's what's happened.
It's crazy. Professor, I'm going to put you on hold really quickly. We had to take a quick commercial break. I have a few more questions about that. If anyone else does too, 312-981-7200. John Hansen here on Let's Get Legal, 448 on this Saturday afternoon. Professor Robin Wilson joining us. And Professor, we're getting some texts in for Free Brittany. And I'm really glad that this conversation is happening about our conservatorship. But I imagine, Professor Wilson, that hers is not the only one in which her allegations that people are abusing the system, making money off of this. I'm sure there are others out there, and people don't have the public ability to rally people around them. I imagine that the conservatorship, while there's many that work great, it is an area ripe for people to take advantage of other people.
Well, I think that, I mean, yeah, your autonomy, your ability to act for yourself is handed over to someone else. And, you know, just being, you know, alive, that sometimes people don't always have your best interest at heart. You know, I think in the disabled cases that I was talking about, the parents very much do, right? They're losing their adult children. But we use things like conservatorship with aging parents, where we don't really have any reason to believe that someone is, you know, necessarily adverse to the parent's interest, like their adult child. But there'll be places where you've seen adult children fight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you felt like one of the people really cared about what was happening to the parent, and the other one maybe cared about their money, right? So in some sense, Brittany is just a high wattage, you know, example of things that we see every day in our own experience.
What sorts of, you mentioned that you use Britney Spears in class about the conservatorship, but also at her history. That's interesting. I imagine other cases, it provides a lens for students, something that is in the public eye, kind of like we're doing now, to offer a broad range of ideas coming out of that, right? Like, that's the start of the conversation. I imagine students enjoy that kind of conversation back and forth. I mean, I think that's an important thing for understanding the law.
No, it is. I mean, we take, like, you know, the supposed to be her annulment papers, for example, from the Vegas wedding. And, you know, you have to file a couple-page document that says these are the reasons I think this marriage can be annulled. And it really kind of gives you some sense of what it means to be married. Like, why does a state even have an interest? So, yeah, students really love that. You know, one of the saddest things in listening to her the other day is, you know, I was taking down the list of, like, constitutional rights that people have. She's saying that she doesn't have the ability to marry. Right? She's saying that she doesn't have the ability to remove this IUD that she has inside of her, right? I mean, these are like fundamental, you know, liberties that
right.
people generally have, for which she has been, from which she's been disabled. You know, and I do teach in part of family law the right to marry cases, like Obergefell, same-sex marriage, you know. But there are these famous cases where you'd have somebody who was behind on their child support in Wisconsin, in this case called Zablocki, actually tried to say to somebody who was behind on their child support they couldn't marry. And the U.S. Supreme Court struck that. They're like, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear Brittany going, I can't marry. My dad and everybody around me is not letting me marry. They won't let me ride in a car with my boyfriend. And it's stunning, in a sense, when you teach this body of law to realize how many things have, she says, have been taken from her.
Is her only avenue of recourse what she's doing, going through this process of appealing the conservatorship, or can she enter a different, you know, court track to get to the Supreme Court on this? Or, you know what I mean? Like, file in district court about a specific limitation that's put on her, or does the conservatorship hold up in court if she were to try and challenge that through another means? I know that's not the best worded question, but I hope you can make sense of what I was trying to ask.
You know, it's a good question, John. I mean, I thought about it the other day. Could she just file in another jurisdiction?
Right.
I went and looked, actually. And I think her conservatorship is in California. And until that California court yields its authority, another court could not get in it. So I think she has to actually appeal from the judge's findings that they deny the end of the conservatorship. That's the way I understand it as a procedural matter. What I think is super interesting is this is supposed to be about her money, her ability to take care of her own money. So why are all of these other things being regulated, like whether she can see her boyfriend, right? I mean, you feel like this kid's been grounded in her room in high school or something. You know, how come all of the other things follow from it? And it's interesting because I think you could tailor conservatorships to the specific disability that somebody, I'm using disability and like with scarecrows, but to the specific thing that led you to have a conservatorship and not spill over to every aspect of their life. But instead, it's acting like a binary switch. Okay, if you can't regulate your money, bam, you don't get to regulate anything. And I think the state, I think this will, Free Brittany will actually, I think, inspire state lawmakers to look at whether they needed to blast on this and like take everything from people, or whether they should tailor the remedy to the thing that the people can't do. And just think about that. Even in you know, we think about mature minor doctrines. I don't know if you know what that
no,
is.
No, I don't.
It's like, okay, so like a mature minor says, well, we get that minors aren't 18 or 21 yet. They can't make every good decision for themselves, but some of them they're mature enough to make. So think in a custody context, we'll often ask children, which parent do you want to live with? Or in the reproductive rights context, we'll say, okay, this child might not be old enough to live on their own, but they're old enough to decide if they're going to have an abortion, right? So it's tailored to specific zones of decision making. And then the age is like a sliding scale. But what do you have with Brittany? It's almost like Brittany's been made to be an 8-year-old forevermore, right? Well, we're not even in that zone, not thinking about Brittany like we would think about another teenager.
I'm kind of surprised they aren't tailored that way. I had assumed that all of these things that she was referencing were specific things that were in the conservatorship at the beginning. Are you suggesting that when you get into a conservatorship, it's a little bit more broadly applied to an all-reaching sort of thing, and that in order to change those sorts of things, state lawmakers need to go and say, no, this needs to be like a line-by-line situation, or are there some that are and some that aren't?
I haven't looked enough at each of the states, but my understanding is that it was about money, but it incapacitates her as to all of these things. And you're right. My argument here is that the incapacity, the legal incapacity, should be more tailored to those things that, you know, she's not able to do, but not spill over to everything. So if your whole goal was to conserve her assets because she was maybe not able to conserve them, then do that. But don't disable her from everything. I mean, she says she's being made to take lithium, for example, which I know is, you know, very strong drug. You know, she doesn't want to take lithium. You know, I think she should be heard on whether she wants to take lithium. Mind-boggling stuff.
It's interesting that you, it's just because sometimes it takes a public case like this, a celebrity like this, to create a movement behind things that in many years and decades, if laws are changed because of this, it will be because of Britney Spears, which I think 20 years ago would have been mind-boggling to anyone that maybe one day there's a Britney Spears Supreme Court case, but sometimes that's what helps change things.
Yeah, I mean, it was another Britney only a few years ago, John Britney Maynard.
Yeah.
Changed how you think about death and dying because she had to move all across country in order to have control over the manner of her own death. So, yeah, I give, I mean, big props in my view to Britney Spears. I thought it took tremendous guts to say what she said, and she clearly didn't. It wasn't working lockstep with her own counsel. He seemed to be ticked off that she seems to have gone off script. I personally found it very effective. I really did.
Yeah. Professor Wilson from the University of Illinois College of Law, really appreciate your time and breaking this down for us.
No problem.
I thought you were going to end with a free Britney there, Professor.
Yeah, I should. Free Britney.
Okay. I thought you were ready for that. Okay, I'll prep you better next time. That's my bad. Thanks, Professor.
Okay, thank you, sir. See you.
All right, quick break, then we'll wrap things up on Let's Get Legal. And as you hear, we're just about wrapping things up. Want to thank Iridian for our wonderful producing. Nice job, first show of Let's Get Legal in the bag.
Right? I know, I think we did a good job.
You ready for a quick rapid fire? We got about 30 seconds here.
Let's do it.
Laws in states that are goofy. Fill in the blank, your best guess. Rapid fire, here we go. In Georgia, you can't live on what for more than 30 days? Iridian, any guesses?
Property?
Nope, a boat. In Florida, you're liable for your dog if they bite someone at your house unless you have a sign that says...
I have no idea.
Bad dog. You must say bad dog. I have a sign. In Indiana, you can't fish using what?
Jesus, what could it be? Everything's legal in Indiana.
Can't fish with a gun. We'll be back next week with more Let's Get Legal. Time for the news on WGN.